Today is the 200th anniversary of the day Mexico began its war against Spain for independence. This year is also the 100th anniversary of the Mexican Revolution, and today we spend the hour on Mexico's politics, history, and art. The traditional El Grito celebration on the eve of Mexican Independence Day was severely toned down last night in the city of Juarez, as well as other cities, where increased violence has cast a pall on the festivities. In the first part of our one-hour-long special on Mexico's bicentennial, we'll focus on the politics behind the drug violence and how it relates to NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, as well as the U.S.-backed drug war in Mexico. More than 15 years ago, a crucial article in Mexico's constitution was removed, which guaranteed land redistribution, particularly to Mexico's indigenous and poor people. The move came as a condition of the North America Free Trade Agreement, an agreement between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada that promised to boost the economies of all three countries. However, Mexico's economy paid the biggest price, resulting in widespread impoverishment, a great migration of workers north of the border to the U.S., the rise of the drug trade and mafia, and ultimately a militarization of the border with enthusiastic support from the U.S. government. Under Mexico's current president, Felipe Calderón, nearly 30,000 people have been killed in the war between government forces and drug traffickers. It's been well documented that U.S. weapons are used on both sides of the war. Just days ago, 25 people were killed in drug-related violence in Juarez, the deadliest such day in 3 years. In late August, the bodies of 72 migrants were found shot dead, likely while on their way to the U.S., one of Mexico's major drug cartels is suspected of carrying out the massacre. Weeks later, the bodies of two missing law enforcement officials investigating those murdered were found. In light of such violence, Manuel Perez Rocha, a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus, writes, quote, "Millions of Mexicans like me feel skeptical and unenthusiastic about cheering for either our independence or our revolution." Manuel Perez Rocha joins me on the phone now. He's also an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thanks so much for joining us today. Should I wish you happy Independence Day?
Yes, and in part. I feel a little bit like a party spoiler now, but I want to. I yesterday released an article in Foreign Policy in Focus, and I want to start talking about the very end of the article, how I finished the article. And I said that I don't want to miss the celebration, but I will simply postpone it. And this is not only in relation to the bad situation the country is now, but also keeping with Mexican history. I'm saying that after all, both Mexico's independence and Mexico's revolution both took a decade or so to complete. So I'm saying that perhaps the true centennial and the true bicentennial celebration of these events might come later, like in 10 years or so, when independence in Mexico is secured and revolutionary ideals are achieved. So this is a moment for us, for Mexicans, to continue struggling and change the dire situation the country is in, and perhaps we will be able to celebrate more cheerfully in a few years.
Now, one of the theories about Mexico's poverty and also the drug war goes like this. After free trade and NAFTA wiped out Mexico's traditional agriculture, the drug cartels moved in. Is this accurate, and is this the best way to understand in a sort of a nutshell the ongoing violence and poverty?
Well, this is one of the roots of the destruction of the social fabric in Mexico, particularly in the countryside. In 1994, before NAFTA was implemented, former President Salinas de Gortari, whose election was also marked by fraud, he carried a very important act in reversing the ideals of the Mexican Revolution, and he wiped out the Article 27 that proclaimed Mexicans as the owners of the land and the water of the nation. This article called for an agrarian reform of land redistribution to peasants and provided for common ownership of the land. So the social fabric in the countryside was organized under the system of ejidos. What Salinas came to do was to say that it was time to modernize the countryside and bring it into line with the other NAFTA partners and to make the lands in the countryside subject to be sold, even to foreigners. So this way he started destroying the social fabric in the countryside in Mexico. This together with opening up the markets for the cheap subsidized corn coming from the United States into Mexico finished wiping out the capacity of peasants in Mexico to survive. Millions of livelihoods were lost, And this is where there, I'm not going to say that there wasn't poverty in Mexico before, but there were some support mechanisms for the peasants in Mexico before, and they had also this communal system of lands in which they had certain support amongst the communities. But after 1994, the real destruction of Mexico's social fabric started, and the massive flight from the countryside to the cities started, and then to the United States. Migration to the United States doubled up after NAFTA. So this has obviously a relation to poverty and to violence, because a lot of people, a lot of young people in Mexico just don't have any opportunities at all. I'm saying in my article also how it's estimated that 7.5 million young Mexicans from 12 years to 29 years don't have any opportunities of work or study. So this is creating, as we say in Spanish, un caldo de cultivo, like a broth for the germination of violence.
Well, how do you fully explain then the rise of the drug war? If NAFTA was and the removal of Article 27 of the Constitution by President Salinas were responsible for poverty and migration, did that directly give rise to the drug war as we're seeing it today, or are there some other missing ingredients?
No, there are, of course, other missing ingredients. I'm not going to say, and I really want to remark this, that poverty doesn't equal criminalization. I mean, and mm-hmm. It would be a very big mistake that say that poor people are turning into criminals automatically, and that is not so. The narco gangs are very ruthless people with a lot of power, with a lot of arms. Most of them come from the United States into Mexico. But what they're doing is employing and using the worst possible techniques to bring some of the more desperate people into their ranks, you know. And sometimes they're even against their will. Very, very poor people, like the migrants that were going from Latin America to the United States and passed through Mexico and were killed a few weeks ago, these 72 migrants. One of the most plausible explanations is that they were killed because they refused to work for the narco-traffickers. So the fact that there is a lot of people that don't have any capacity to defend themselves, they fall into the traps of this narco-economy.
Now, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, here in the U.S., recently made a high-profile comparison of Mexico to Colombia, and she basically opened the door for the kind of drug war that the U.S. has supported in Colombia. But, of course, the U.S. has also been supporting militarily a drug war in Mexico. What sort of help and what sort of cooperation does there already exist between the U.S. government and the Mexican government to combat the drug war?
Well, there's already the Merida Initiative by which the United States has been...
Plan Merida.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the plan... It's called Iniciativa Merida, mm-hmm. and it's dubbed by Mexican groups and others in the States like a Plan Mexico because of its already similarity to Plan Colombia. However, there is an important difference, which is that in Colombia you had the direct intervention of the U.S. military, and in Mexico so far has been through the channeling of money, funds, and arms, but not with the direct intervention of the U.S. military. The latest, that wasn't the latest commentary of Clinton, because later on she sent a congratulation note to the Mexican government, or to Mexico, because of the celebrations. But the recent declaration in which she said that Mexico is looking more and more like Colombia looked 20 years ago, and her branding narco-traffickers as insurgents have freezed the fears against among many Mexicans and United States allies about the intention of propping up or ratcheting up the war on drugs. And there's even been some talks about some mentions about in some political circles about the need of the U.S. to start intervening more directly in Mexico, and even sending troops are being sent to the border. And they're having some suggestions about crossing the border and start helping the Mexican military more directly. And this is very worrying. However, President Obama jumped in very quickly to contradict Clinton and state how different the situation between Colombia and Mexico is.
I'm speaking with Manuel Perez Rocha. He's a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus and an associate fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies. You can read his latest piece at fpif.org called "Don't Celebrate Mexico's Independence Yet." Now, let's talk about the some of the solutions that are being proposed inside Mexico itself. The Mexican government is considering legalizing marijuana in an effort to undermine the drug trafficking. Will this have an impact, you think, if it does get passed?
Well, I think this is, for me personally, this is a minor solution because marijuana is not the only problem. We have other high-potency drugs that are being trafficked between our countries. So you have cocaine, you have heroin, you have many amphetamines. So it would be a partial solution. I think that one of the most important solutions might come from a more decisive intervention from the United States government. It was already recognized by Clinton herself last year that the United States had a very strong co-responsibility. And one of the biggest problems is obviously the trafficking of arms into Mexico. If we from the United States to Mexico, if the high-caliber arms aren't stopped from going to Mexico, it will be difficult to disarm the narco-traffic gangs. So there are a number of there is a very important study that came out recently that it puts in detail how 100 or so stores in the border in the United States are responsible for selling most of the arms to the narco-traffickers in Mexico. So it's very necessary to take some action at the congressional level and pass an initiative of law that helps to prevent this. Mm. This is one measure. The other one is to strengthen the institutional capacity of Mexico to confront the problem. Because, you know, we've always been saying that strengthening the military in Mexico is not necessarily the best solution. And, in fact, it has been contradictory to human rights. There is a huge spike of human rights violations by the military themselves. The military have committed hideous crimes. They have killed innocent people. And complaints from the people in Mexico to the Human Rights Commission have grown 1,000% only during the Calderon's presidency. So instead of focusing all the attention in the military, the collaboration of the United States to Mexico should focus on institutional reform of the judicial system and strengthening and professionalizing the police forces.
And speaking of the police forces, there were recently over 3,000 federal police officers who were recently fired due to corruption, which is about 10% of Mexico's police force. What does that say about the police force?
Well, that's one of the problems, the corruption that is permeating all the police institutions in Mexico and also the government, all the governments, the state governments and the federal government. So if it is necessary to stem corruption from the Mexican institutions in order to start confronting the problem of the narcos. The problem is the narcos have infiltrated a lot of institutions.
So do you think these firings and accusations of corruption and the sort of attempted cleaning up of Mexico's police force is a step in the right direction?
Yeah, I think it's a step in the right direction, yeah. Anything that is done to stem corruption in the institutions is a step in the right direction. That's what I'm proposing.
Now, I want to bring up also other aspects of Mexico's politics. We've talked about the drug war, but the situation of poverty in Mexico remains dire. And also, that seems to be quite closely linked to just public health issues in Mexico. Last year, the swine flu is thought to have originated in Mexico, and many Mexicans, particularly poor people, are suffering from dengue fever and tuberculosis. Even leprosy is rampant. What are some of the, do you see this poor state of public health as, again, directly connected to the free trade agreement and the wholesale impoverishment of Mexicans?
Well, it's connected both to the problems of poverty and also to the lack of prevention. And one of the problems of lack of prevention is the lack of regulation that has been happening because of the deregulation of the economy. So it was demonstrated then during the swine flu crisis how this started from the lack of adequate regulation of hog plants of pigs in the state of Veracruz in Mexico, of large transnationals, I mean, U.S. transnationals that moved after NAFTA from the state of Virginia to Mexico in order to be able to grow and produce its hogs with much less regulations than in the U.S. So this lack of sanitary conditions is what is provoking the growth of several diseases, right? And I want to say the problem in Mexico is that after 16 years, the economy continues in a structural impasse. No, it is completely dependent on the ups and downs of the U.S. market. This has been recognized by, as I mentioned in my article, by Agustin Carstens, who directs the governor of the Bank of Mexico. And every time in Mexico you see that the whole country is just focusing on monitoring what the economy of the United States is behaving to see how the country is going to sort out the crisis.
And I understand even tourism has fallen drastically because of the drug violence, because of the swine flu epidemic, and the other aspect of the economy is Mexico's reliance on oil has also led to the worsening of its economy.
Yeah, you said it. The production of oil has decreased, I understand, between 30 to 40% in the last year. And I don't have the exact figure about tourism. It really plummeted during the swine flu. I don't know how much it has recovered or not, but I suspect that it doesn't have to the levels before the crisis. But I want to stress something very important. Before the crisis, NAFTA's the north of Mexico, the northern part of Mexico, was showcased as an example of NAFTA's virtues. And so theory went that NAFTA has to go more to the south and then Central America, etc. But according to official figures recently reported, the northern cities of Mexico are reporting unemployment levels that are higher than the average of the nation.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in cities like Saltillo, Tijuana, you have 8.5 or 7.9% of official unemployment, because, you know, unemployment in Mexico defines a person that doesn't work even 1 hour, 1 hour a month. Of course,
so it's a conservative measure of unemployment.
So it's completely conservative. If you talk about sub-occupied people, then the figures are much, much higher. But what I want to stress here is that the crisis, the poverty, has reached the north of Mexico, not to mention the violence. You know, even in Monterrey, which is the most important industrial city of Mexico, well, perhaps after Mexico City, but the showcase also about Mexico's modernity, the richest people and the higher medium classes are leaving the city and trying to go to live into the United States because of the state of violence.
Right.
So the
northern cities where NAFTA's stamp is strongest is where you have the greatest unemployment, is basically what you're saying?
Right, yeah.
Also, it should be noted that the world's richest man is from Mexico, a country which has such high levels of poverty. Finally, what about Felipe Calderón's tenure and the attacks on unions that his administration has been marked with? How much has that worsened ordinary people's ability to have normal and decent livelihoods?
Well, it has been a very grave attack for President Felipe Calderón to the unions in Mexico. He has, in the last couple of years, he has dedicated to make a frontal attack on unions. Last year, unconstitutionally, he did away with the job of 44,000 members of the Sindicato Mexicano de Electricistas, the Electricity Workers of Mexico, as well as of 1,200 copper miners in the Cananea mine, to give way to privatization schemes, basically, and in the second case of the miners, to benefit a very elitist group, Mexico, that owns the mine, and to get rid of these workers that have been fighting for decades. Both unions, the Cananea Union and the Sindicato Mexicano de Electricistas, are the oldest democratic independent unions of Mexico. And President Calderón has dedicated himself to attack them and destroy them. But these unions are still fighting, they're still struggling, and they have a lot of support here, an increasing support in the United States from large unions as well as from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, meanwhile, while the people are being affected, attacked, while the unions, the workers have been attacked, and in the last I'm also right how in the last 30 years of economic reforms, supposedly, the purchasing power of the minimum wage has dropped 70% in Mexico. And as you said, meanwhile, fortunes of incredible proportion have been created, like that of super billionaire Carlos Slim, who has become the richest man on earth, thanks to the help, to the hands that presidents like Salinas de Gortari have given him.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Manuel Perez Rocha, for joining us today. We hope to have you back on. And thanks. And we'll also link to your piece from our website, uprisingradio.org, later today.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for the invitation, and I really thank you for letting me talk about all this. I just want to say that with your help, I mean, that I really trust the goodwill and the strong will of the people of Mexico, and we will start reversing the decay that the country has been in the last years.
So maybe in 10 years I can wish you happy Independence Day.
Exactly.
Manuel Perez Rocha is a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus and an associate fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies. His article, latest article, which can be found at fpif.org, is called Don't Celebrate Mexico's Independence Yet.